Good morning. This is Bishop Phoebe Roth of the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. Welcome to Faithfully Memphis. Each Thursday morning, we broadcast live from WYXR 91.7 FM, located at Crosstown Concourse in Memphis. And we always have the opportunity to speak with a special guest to learn more about their work and the role that faith plays in their lives. And of course, we always begin the show with a segment entitled Saint of the Day. It's really great to have these reminders that many ordinary people throughout the generations have done extraordinary things. And so this morning, I want to share a little bit about a woman, Macrina, who was a monastic and theologian and teacher in the 4th century. We celebrated her on our liturgical calendar yesterday, which would have been July the 19th. Macrina founded one of the earliest Christian monastic communities in the Cappadocian city of Pontus, and because she was a woman, we don't really have a lot of her writings to review. We actually know a great deal about her from her brothers. Three of her brothers, Gregory of Nyssa, and Basil, and Peter, became bishops. And in that role, you know, they not only spoke and taught, but they wrote about the impact that she had on their lives. In fact, her brother Gregory described her as holy and brilliant. Pretty incredible descriptors for a woman who lived from 340 to 379. The first thing that Macrina did is that she persuaded her mother to sort of move away from the wealthy lifestyle that the family had been living. They were very privileged. They had a comfortable standard of living. And Macrina said, I want to establish a monastery on the family estate. Let's use our property to help others. And she emphasized caring for the poor and ministering to the wider community. And it turns out that many of the women that she ended up helping decided to devote their lives to God by joining this monastic community. As I mentioned, her brothers Gregory, Basil, and Peter were all bishops, but they often went to her for conversation about matters of doctrine and theology. And supposedly, Macrina often challenged her brothers and pushed them to reconsider some of their beliefs. Under her influence, two of her brothers, Basil and Peter, also renounced most of their material possessions and moved from being academics to becoming monks and theologians. And her brother Gregory included some of her teachings and her statements in two books, Life of Macrina and another volume, On the Soul and Resurrection. So, you know, thinking about being a woman in a position of leadership in the church and some of the challenges that women still face today in the church, it's just amazing to learn about this woman who lived approximately 1,400 years ago and who had such a profound influence, not only through her relationship with her brothers and influencing their episcopate, but also by the care and the concern that she had for vulnerable members of the community and her willingness to share of her own resources with others. So today, we remember Macrina. So we are now at the portion of the show where we get the opportunity to speak with a special guest, and we are pleased to have in the studio with us this morning, Sherry Brand Ray. She is the chair of the English department at St. Mary's Episcopal School, which is one of the schools in our diocese connected on the property of Church of the Holy Communion that serves girls from the earliest age through high school. Sherry is a wife, a mother, a grandmother, a teacher, a speaker, and a writer. She has recently published a collection of essays and stories in a book entitled Surprised by Imperfection. She also has a blog, so we're going to get to talk about some of those things and also her work as a teacher of literature and writing for almost 40 years. So, Sherry, good morning and welcome to Faithfully Memphis.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
It is great to have you in the studio.
It's wonderful to be here.
Now, I want to start because I saw in your materials that your husband is a pastor.
He is.
Is that correct?
He is. He's the pastor of Christ Community Church in East Memphis.
Excellent. Well, I want to just say thank you as a member of the clergy, because without family members, spouses, and loved ones who support us, it would be really difficult for us to sort of live into our vocation. So thank you for that.
How kind of you. I will pass that on to him as well.
Good. So, Sherry, can you tell us a little bit about the role of faith in your life when you were growing up? Were you raised in the church?
So, not until I was about 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And when I was 12 years old, my family joined the Presbyterian Church mm-hmm. in Whitehaven here in Memphis. Mm-hmm. And a little shout out to Whitehaven Presbyterian. It was a wonderful church. It's no longer there. Mm-hmm. And they had a school, and I went to Whitehaven Presbyterian School and was really just introduced to faith and God through the beautiful congregation there mm-hmm. at that church. And then later we moved to the Baptist church, and I stayed there for quite a while. Mm-hmm. So early on, my family kind of as a group went from being a family that really didn't practice faith mm-hmm. to all of us practicing faith and beginning to grow in our love for God and the church. And in particular, my father had a great influence on me, mm-hmm. my mother as well.
Yeah.
But my father and I came to faith almost the same at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a weekend event.
Wow.
And he took me as a child, mm-hmm. and we had great conversations after that event. And so from that point on, faith has been the most important
mm-hmm. yeah.
part of how I see the world, how I envision myself in the world mm-hmm. and in my work.
Wow. So did you know from an early age that you had a calling to be an educator?
I think I did. Mm-hmm. When I was going through high school, English was mm-hmm. my favorite subject, and I had a teacher, both junior and senior year, Mr. Crawford, mm-hmm. who everyone loved. He was a master teacher, but really influenced me in my love for literature, in my ability to read literature with a fine, you know, and comb it with a fine tooth comb.
Yeah.
And the other thing about Mr. Crawford that was so terrific was that he was a teacher for everyone. So what I mean by that is lots of students didn't enjoy reading. The material that we were reading was difficult, Shakespeare and some older pieces. And he brought everybody to a place where they could understand and appreciate. He had such a love for the words.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think from that point, I thought, I'd like to do that. Mm-hmm. In college, I had a variety of majors for a variety of years.
That's not uncommon.
No. An accounting major, which was a terrible idea for me. I don't know what I was thinking. A history major for a minute. And then landed in English major, which was the correct spot for me. And I think I knew since I sat in Mr. Crawford's classes.
Wow.
That I wanted to be a teacher. And it is a career that I would choose again mm-hmm. and again.
Yeah. Hopefully, you know, all of our listeners can think mm-hmm. back fondly on at least one teacher who made a huge impact in their lives. And, you know, there were several for me, but the first one who comes to mind is Acetyl. Hmm. And she was not only my teacher, but she also was over the student government. And so when I ran for student government officer, I was able to work with her in both capacities. And yeah, you're right. Someone who can sort of unpack things in a new way, it just expands your horizons.
It does. It does. He pulled us all through the study of Macbeth and Hamlet.
Yeah.
And of course, I loved reading that mm-hmm. and exploring those ideas in that difficult language, but not everyone.
Right. Exactly.
And he brought that old stuff to life for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that I'm able to do that a little bit to my students as well.
Yeah, yeah. So if you've been involved in teaching for almost four decades, I would imagine that you've seen a lot of things over the years. As you reflect back, you know, are there things that all students tend to have in common? Are there things that maybe are unique to this current generation of students? We hear so much about the various generations, the millennials and right. the Gen X and the Gen Z, and I'm not even sure what all these different things are. And it does seem that each generation of young folks maybe have some particular gifts or skills or attitudes or perspectives. What have you observed?
That's such a good question. And I have kind of two big uh-huh. observations mm-hmm. for this. One, I kind of am of the opinion that while culture changes, excuse me, and things change from generation to generation, mm-hmm. the human experience itself, human beings in the world mm. with one another, loving one another or not loving one another, mm. that core experience doesn't change a great deal.
Mm.
So what I mean by that is what we see today, we also saw in ancient times, in biblical times,
yep.
and, you know, brother hating brother, mm-hmm. brother loving brother, brother killing brother. And so my personal thought on that is that that core hasn't changed very much.
Mm-hmm.
And that we still need to be teaching people, I work with teenagers, teaching people and showing people what's really important mm-hmm. as a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And while I think literature is very important and it's reflective of our whole experience here mm-hmm. as humans, for me, being in the classroom and teaching girls, I teach girls, literature, which is so important, but so is love mm-hmm. and diversity. And what do we do when someone has said something that we disagree with?
Mm-hmm.
I may be a slightly away from your question, but one thing that's very important to all of us at St. Mary's is teaching girls how to have true civil discourse.
Yes.
We live in polarized times. Yes. And I say again, I think that's, if we look at history,
it's always existed. Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's mm-hmm. always existed. So we can hope that it gets better in the future. Mm-hmm. I certainly hope and pray that it does. But right this minute in these polarized times, we need to be good examples to these 16, 17, 18-year-old, and 2- and 3-year-olds.
Yes.
Of how grown-ups who might disagree politically, religiously,
mm-hmm.
economically,
mm-hmm.
can have civil conversations and still at the end of it disagree and live comfortably together. And
yes.
Best case scenario, love one another.
Yes.
That said, you know, these are times where we know this, anxieties mm-hmm. are up, and mm-hmm. we have all sorts of reasons and causes for people's anxieties to be high. So I think it's important for those of us in education to acknowledge that.
Yes.
And to acknowledge the differences that people bring, mm-hmm. abilities, and again, find places in literature, places in scripture, mm-hmm. if it's appropriate,
mm-hmm.
to say, I see you and I hear that. And let me offer to you what this person did. I'm so happy that you gave us Macrina this
morning. Yes.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes.
To listen to her story and to say, well, now, this is a woman in mm-hmm. ancient times who was maybe didn't have quite the ability to publish on her own
mm-hmm.
in those days, but her influence among her brothers and her family extended immensely.
Right.
And to bring those things to the girls. And I think a big part of my job, my calling, is to bring hope to students as well.
Yeah.
Did that answer your question?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the things that is really different in the current generation of students is social media. And I have mixed feelings about social media.
Well, there we are sisters in this.
So many powerful, positive contributions.
Yes.
It's made the world smaller.
Yes.
If I can get up and turn on the small computer that we all carry right in our pockets and our purses, the cell phones, and immediately know what's happening in Syria.
Yes.
In South Sudan.
In Ukraine.
In Ukraine, in Vermont with the flooding, right? That's a tool that can bring people together.
It can.
And yet, there can also be a lot of negativity that goes out across social media. And I'm thinking about, in particular, with young women.
Yes.
Your constituency and body image.
Yes.
And seeing these photoshopped, airbrushed images that aren't real.
Right.
And then trying to conform their bodies, which are already beautiful.
Yes.
To something that they don't need to do. And so from that standpoint, I think there are pressures facing this generation that, quite frankly, I didn't face as a girl growing up in Arkansas in the 1970s, because we didn't even have, there was no internet, there were no video games, we didn't even have computers, you know?
We had the television.
And we ran outside and played.
And we played outside.
Exactly. How do your girls handle all of the things that go along with the advent of social media?
That is such a great question, such a huge topic.
Yeah.
And I certainly can't speak for all
everybody,
the girls.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. But you have hit the nail on the head, so to speak. It is difficult on young women to see these stylized, idealized, photoshopped people, and to see, I'll tell you another thing as well, to see other groups, like people going to college is a thing.
Oh,
and
okay.
So I have mostly seniors.
Yes.
They watch their friends go to college, and what's posted, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing.
Right.
What is posted is friends, friends, friends. Right. Everybody is beautiful. Everybody is perfect. And so when I then, next year, go to college, and I have a difficult day, or I don't get in the sorority.
Right.
Or I don't like my roommate, or I'm there 2 weeks and I haven't found my friend group yet.
Yeah.
Those pressures are very real.
Yeah.
What we do in school, at school, is talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
Try to be honest about it. Mm-hmm. Sadly, it's not going anywhere.
Right. Right.
Talk to girls about self-control.
Yeah.
Talk to girls about the truth of it.
Yeah.
And again, listen and talk, which is the way girls learn anyway.
Yeah.
Listen and talk, read and talk, listen and talk.
Yeah.
I wish I had a better, more compact answer.
Oh, no. Yeah.
I am no fan of social media when it comes to the influence that it has on young girl self-esteem and body image. It's tough.
Yeah. It's a challenge, you know, as someone who, you know, the current model of being a bishop requires that you have a social media presence.
Right.
And so I have a professional Facebook page, and I'm very fortunate to have an excellent director of communications who keeps us updated on, you know, Instagram and other platforms. And that's just kind of where we are. And yet sometimes, even as I look back, and Facebook will occasionally, you know, send you 4 years ago today,
a memory,
this is what you posted. It is overwhelmingly the positive things because it's challenging. You know, if I'm having a bad day at the office or in my personal life, what is the appropriate forum, right, for sharing that and for venting and understanding me being in a position of authority if I vent about certain things, it's not even appropriate. But I do think that as I look back on my former posts, it's not the full version of the story. It's not that what I posted was inaccurate or a lie. It just is incomplete.
That's such a great point. It's just not all
there is. It's not all of it at all. And the struggles and the challenges I don't put on social media.
Yeah. We don't want anybody, well, normally we don't want anybody to see that. Yeah. We don't want anybody to know about that. We try to hide those things.
Yeah.
One thing I think is important also, and we talk to our parents about this, mm-hmm. is parents being involved as much as they can be. And of course, when people are younger, it's easier perhaps than when they're 17 mm-hmm. or 18 years old and about to be on their own in college anyway. But parents being aware of, and I think they are, but being made aware constantly of how difficult that is.
Yeah.
Exactly. But you're right. We put on social media what we want everyone to see. It's competitive that way, isn't it?
It is.
I want you to see how good I look today.
Right.
Tomorrow in all this humidity when my hair looks terrible.
You might not post.
I'll stay off today, yeah.
Exactly. Man, challenges.
Yes.
Well, I imagine that after many years of studying literature, reading literature, enjoying literature, something prompted you to start writing yourself. And I actually learned about your book, Surprised by Imperfection, earlier this year. Emily Austin, our director of communications, put together a Lenten guide listing all of the programs and Lenten activities from throughout the diocese, and decided to include artwork and original works of either poetry or essays or reflection by our clergy and parishioners from throughout the diocese.
What a great idea.
And two of your short essays were included. So what led you, Sherry, to think now is the time to pull together these various writings into a book?
That's a great question. I'll start with an anecdote.
Sure.
A peer of mine, a colleague at school, this book came out this past November.
Okay.
And so last summer, I was talking to this person, and he said, "So you're finally getting around to it."
Ah.
And why did you wait so long was his question. Now, I'm of a certain age, and my colleague is of a much younger age.
Yes.
And so I knew what that meant.
Yes.
That meant you're pretty old to just be getting started. We lived with my husband's job, working within denomination. We lived in Belgium in Europe for 4 years.
Okay.
Back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. It was a terrific time. It was a wonderful time for me. It was the only time in my whole career that I wasn't teaching because I didn't have the visa to do that. And so during that time, when I actually had a lot of time, my daughter was in school, my husband was working, I started writing very routinely then and got pieces published in various magazines and journals back then, started writing as a daily discipline.
Mm-hmm.
But then we moved back, got busy, came to work, got back to work, and which I love. And I kept the discipline, and I've always wanted to publish. But, you know, it is not easy to publish. So I just kept writing and getting things published here and there, just an essay here and there. And then a couple of years ago, I did a thing where I posted something every single day of Lent.
Oh, okay. So that was part of your Lenten discipline.
It was. Mm-hmm. I wanted just a photograph or some kind of thing that I had written about Lent and what it meant to me. And that was my discipline. And I posted that for 40 days, which was a lot.
Yeah.
And people would say things like, "Oh, we really like that. You should write a book. You should write a book." Mm-hmm. People say that.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, a person said to me, "You should write a book." And I said, "You should find me a publisher." And she said, "My sister-in-law is married to a man who publishes and operates a small publishing house." So we connected.
Wow.
And I found a home for 25 years of writing.
Wow.
You know, And he is terrific, and it's a wonderful collaboration. You might not know that I have another book coming out in November.
I didn't know. Oh, tell us a little bit. Give us a preview.
It is hopefully the second in a three-part book box set, if you will. Surprised by Imperfection will be number one. We'll talk about that in a second. Surprised by Glory is number two. And I don't know what number three will be just yet. I'm thinking about it. But Surprised by Imperfection, that title in these essays, I hope answers our question about dealing with talking with girls and teenagers in this culture.
Yeah.
I am a person who was born with a small arm. And so I am physically imperfect. Now, we could argue that everyone, no one's perfect and all that, which is our point. No one's perfect. But for me, these essays reflect the fact that I'm imperfect. I know that I am. I want you to view me as not being perfect. I don't want you to look at me and expect perfection. And yet sometimes I do that. I look at you in relationship. You as my friend. You as my spouse. You as my colleague. You as my student. And I am surprised that you aren't everything I think you need to be.
Right.
And I hope these essays show us, show the reader beauty, even in a, especially in a difficult time, an imperfect situation, and give us, it's not a self-help book at all.
Right.
It is a, a book of essays, but give us some fuel to view our own imperfections as the way God made us.
Yeah.
But also seeing that in you and being full of grace for your imperfections in our relationships rather than perhaps disdain.
So maybe to afford other people and yourself a little compassion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Would it be okay if I read a little bit from one of the essays?
Of course.
So one of the two essays that we published was Each Its Own and None the Same. And this is the very last sentence from that essay. Well, I am neither saint nor poet, but I find when I consider my place amidst the vast vastness and singularity and precision and sheer raw numbers involved in the study of an observation of an awe of creation, all I've got left is humility. And I suppose that's a fine enough place to start. Wow, that is so beautiful and profound. And so could you share a little bit about sort of your process of writing? Because the way your choice of words and how they were put together is powerful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So every writer, I read a lot of writers' journals and how they did that and how she accomplished that. And I've come to understand that every writer's technique and every writer's style and every writer's approach is as different as every speaker's approach or theologian's study. But for me, I get the idea and then allow myself just to write as much as I can about that idea, even when I know the sentences aren't good, the sentences aren't complete, they're not beautiful, but I know that if I don't write it down, pretty much the minute I think of it, so I keep, you know, paper with me all the time, I'll forget it. We forget it.
Right.
And you think, same with dreams. If you wake up with a dream or you've had
you need to have a journal by your bedside or your nightstand.
Absolutely. Yeah. And even though you might have to get up at 2 a.m. and turn the light on, it is worth it because that will go away. And so I write all the ideas that I have about a certain topic. Some of it is just terrible. And then go back, set it aside for a little while, come back to it, see, I don't do it immediately often, see what is there, if there's anything there. Sometimes it was a good idea, but it's not something I think I'll be able to flesh out. Sometimes there's a good idea. Sometimes there's a good phrase. I keep reading notes of all the books that I read of good phrases that people write. Mm-hmm. Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
Not to use them myself, of course, but to see, oh, that particular metaphor I hadn't thought about.
Mm-hmm.
And then go back and go back and go back and go back and craft each sentence. I like to play with verbs. I like to play with making a noun a verb or mm-hmm. an adjective a verb, play with language a little bit like that. If you read much of the work, you'll see I kind of like lists. So there might be two or three verbs in a row, like in the mm-hmm. sentence that you chose.
Right, right.
Every essay is different. Every time you sit down to write is different. But not to be afraid to write lots and lots of just terrible sentences. And then all of a sudden, there'll be a good thought.
Mm-hmm.
And you might could use some of the other that you've written to build on that thought. Maybe not. Mm. I tell my students one of the scariest moments is when you sit down to a blank screen, that mm-hmm. little cursor
yeah, right.
is pulsing, kind of like, yeah, do your, it's kind of a temptation, like, give it your best shot.
Right.
Do, give it mm-hmm. your best shot. Write it down and then go back. Don't accept your first ideas. Go back, go back, go back. And the students will say, Ms. Ray, when is my paper finished? Or when is an essay finished? When's it finished? It's never finished.
Yeah. Yep.
It is finished when someone says to you, an editor, a teacher, the person with a deadline, tomorrow at 8 is when you, that's when it's finished.
Yeah.
And then it stands alone in the universe. And then you have to say, I have to say, when you began to read, I thought with just a little tremor, oh, I wonder what it is.
Yeah.
Because it now exists.
Right.
Apart from me.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. So this book has been published. It sounds like another book is coming out in November.
Yes.
If any of our listeners would be interested in getting a copy of the book, Surprised by Imperfection, how could they do that?
So it's at Novel Books.
Okay. Novel Books is right in Memphis.
Right there in Memphis. They can contact me or it's on Amazon.
Oh, wonderful.
So.
Got it.
There it is.
Great.
I'm sorry. It's on online pretty much everywhere you look, I think.
Good. So if they Google Surprised by Imperfection, it'll come up.
It will.
Excellent. Excellent.
Thank you.
Well, your words certainly provide a lot of hope to others. And I wonder, as we come to the conclusion of our conversation, what is it that gives you hope? You know, what keeps you going in the midst of, you know, challenging times that we find ourselves in?
I have a practice, a faith practice, of reading the scripture every morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a great way for me. And I would encourage others to do that, because for me, that has been a great hope. And I think of someone like King David in the Psalms. It's interesting to read through the Psalms because, and you would know, Bishop, far more than I, which ones, but some of the Psalms are songs of praise.
Right.
And
some
adoration.
Are lament. Yeah.
And some he is in a cave.
Oh, yeah.
Being chased by an enemy mm-hmm. and he thinks his life is over.
Mm-hmm.
That there is it brings me hope. Like I said in the earlier part of the time today, to know that others have gone through hard times.
Yes.
And have stayed faithful to God, have stayed faithful in their hope of joy
mm-hmm.
and, frankly, better times to come.
Mm-hmm.
Over the course of these years, I hope I have learned to be more honest in my conversations.
Mm-hmm.
By personality, I am a person who likes to, and there's an essay in the book about this, who likes to make sure everybody in the room is happy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody is okay. Everybody's, you could call that peacekeeping. Somebody mm-hmm. told me one time, there's a difference, you know, a friend told me there's a difference, you know, between peacemaking and peacekeeping.
Mm.
And that was a pivotal point for me because I can flutter around and make mm-hmm. sure everybody feels good and not be honest with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so learning to be honest in our conversations mm-hmm. with my friends and has brought me hope.
Yeah.
My belief in God
mm-hmm.
as the creator and maintainer and sustainer gives me hope when things do look bleak.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't, I can't spin a positive spin on the situation.
Yeah.
Knowing that there is, for me, someone in control gives me hope, and my students give me hope.
Yeah.
They are bright and funny, and it's interesting because in my job, I age, but the students never age.
Ah, that's interesting.
Everybody walks in 17 and walks out 18.
Yeah.
And the chasm between their age and mine is so great now that it's pleasant in an unusual way. Mm. I don't know what they're talking about. They'll talk about this, that, and the other. Miss Ray, watch this little video. Isn't that funny? I don't find it funny at all. I don't even understand. And it is, it's delightful.
Yeah.
They delight in showing me things. I delight in learning from them. I delight in showing them things.
Yeah.
This one last thing. People will say to me, when are you going to retire?
Mm.
When do you plan on retiring? And every year about March or April when I'm tired, I'll think, I don't know about that. Maybe the next this, that, and the other. And then August rolls around and school starts back. And they come in, all 17, all over again. And they bring me hope. And so I love what I do.
Yeah.
So my students bring me hope.
Yeah. Well, you are certainly blessed to have found a vocation that feeds you in that way, because we know many folks who need to put food on the table pay a mortgage.
That's right.
Find themselves in jobs where they don't have a sense of joy.
Yeah.
So thank you for allowing your joy for what you do to kind of spill out and infuse others with a spirit of hope. It's really been wonderful talking with you today.
Thank you so much for this time, and thank you so much for our new friendship.
Excellent. Thank you for tuning in for another episode of Faithfully Memphis. We really appreciate our listening audience, and just a reminder that you can hear this show anywhere you hear your other podcasts, either on Spotify or Apple Music. So we encourage you to not only listen, but to subscribe and to give us comments if you've got ideas or suggestions or feedback that would be important for us to hear. For those of you in the Memphis metro area, I want to make you aware of a very significant event in the life of our diocese that is taking place in September. St. Mary's Cathedral, which has been a house of prayer for all people since 1858, is completing a significant renovation project. The work that has been done on that space is so beautiful. And we're having a service on Saturday, September the 9th at 5 p.m., where the cathedral will actually be rededicated, because worship hasn't taken place in that space since January. The members of the cathedral community have been worshiping in Sister's Chapel, which is actually the oldest part of the building. But the grand nave with the wonderful high ceilings and the beautiful stained glass windows and the high altar and the great organ, all of that hasn't been used for several months. So St. Mary's Cathedral is located at 700 Poplar Avenue in Memphis, and everyone is welcome to join us that Saturday, September the 9th, as we rededicate this space to God's glory. So until next week, friends, stay safe and stay positive.